Thanks. My name is Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Yeah.
Grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's my 11th week doing this, and we did the 12-week step series before that. And I think I was here when Moses was alive. June 23rd, 1988 was my separation from alcohol. I can't believe I'm around this long. Stuck around this long. I was talking about it to Marion, many of you know Marion earlier, and she was making, as Marion does, a big thing about this. And it's interesting, you get excited with anniversaries and you're grateful for anniversaries, but every once in a while you wonder, like, I actually stuck around this long and didn't ruin it like I would usually ruin good things. So I feel very blessed and grateful for that, having an AA birthday. It's not here yet, but it's getting here. We looked at the first 10 steps so far, and what I've come to experience and hopefully convey to you was, in the first 9 steps, somewhere in there we access this power called God. And we clean out self-will for the most part, where we're left with just very little, or hopefully nothing, but very little obstacles in our path between us and God, which means we're now experiencing integration with God or oneness with God, and we're operating on that kind of plane, a spiritual plane. It doesn't mean that self is not going to rear its ugly head or want maybe to want a manifestation, the many manifestations of self, but for the most part, we've kind of transcend a lot of that, and it's only because of accessing power, not because we're really good people or super AA members. It's just we come to a fellowship and access this power. And in 1 through 9, we will get that. We get power. We're not the power, but we get power. And that's the power that we have a relationship with that allows us a day at a time to experience permanent sobriety and free from self and free from ego and free from the 7 deadly sins. And when I say free of that stuff, I don't mean where they're not going to kick in every so often. That's why we have inventory and amends to make. And last week we talked about step 10. We look at 4 through 9 on a daily basis. I'm not one of those folks, although I was at one point. Do the steps one time and live in 10, 11, and 12 and stay there. And some folks do that and they swear by it. And if it floats their boat, great. I was one of those folks, and I found after a number of years that it was getting dry. And it wasn't even darkness of the soul. It wasn't that I wasn't doing inventory. It wasn't that I wasn't... I was doing all the things I was being asked to do. And I just felt like I couldn't connect. And the inventories got to be mundane, and the prayer got dry. Dark night of the soul, that's what I was looking for. It wasn't that. I didn't know what it was. And I came in contact accidentally through a series of events with a gentleman from Texas. And he was from a completely different lineage. And his lineage was reworking the first 9 steps, not repeating another 4th step, but doing a 4th step and taking a look at where we were disturbed and agitated with people, institutions, principles, what new fears are showing up, what fears are not resolved in the sex inventory. And they talked about doing 1 through 9 into 10, 11, and 12 at least once a year. And when I first heard this, I thought it was blasphemy in AA. Because I didn't hear this ever before. And I had so much contempt prior to investigation. In fact, this gentleman, Mark, when he came to speak at a meeting in Staten Island, I challenged him on it in a very, very prideful, arrogant way. And like any elder who's spiritually fit, he wasn't disturbed, but he recognized where I was coming from. And I got a hold of some of his cassette tapes. Back in the day, we had cassette tapes. And the first time I heard his talk on a cassette tape, I hated him. I said, this arrogant, pompous, know-it-all, I hate this man, and I put it in again. And, you know, the cassette players in the cars, you know. And I listened to it again. I said, oh, my God, I hate this guy. He thinks who the heck he is. And I finished, I put it in again. And I was listening to it. And I had a cassette player, you know, the old stereos with the cassette players. And I had that in there. And I played in the house. And I started to fall in love with this guy because I realized he was speaking truth. And it was my ego that was getting disturbed. And he got in front of me. He was in New York for a conference. And I approached him to sponsor me. And he said to me, are you willing to have your life turned upside down? And I said, well, no, but let's go for it. And it was quickly, because he challenged everything. He challenged my ideas about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. He challenged my ideas about the Big Book, about God, about the 12 steps. And then he handed me something called the set-aside prayer, the lay-aside prayer. And that was, God, please let me lay aside everything I think I know about the Big Book, the 12 steps, AA and you, God, for an open mind and a new experience. God, please let me see my truth. And he told me, what you've learned right now is in the way of having a new experience. Every time I go through the work, regardless of the profound experiences or new knowledge I've acquired, at that moment when I put pen to paper and begin to go through the 12 steps again, all that stuff now stands in the way of having a new experience. And so what I was told, we're not saying it's right or wrong, we're just going to put it, lay it aside for a moment. It'll meet me somewhere in that work. But for now, we need to be a clean blackboard, clean slate to have a new experience. And I understood that. And I was willing to have this new experience because I was sick of wearing the world like a heavy garment. And I was sober a number of years. And he threw some considerations out at me with just step one. The way my current sponsor, Mickey, the first assignment he gave me was the circle and the triangle. And I thought that was below me. But when he gave me considerations about the circle and the triangle, I saw things and heard things I never saw before or heard before. And that's what Mark did. And I got a look at step one, and I never knew there were two parts to step one. And I had to look for unmanageability now compared to unmanageability that's always present. And I remember feeling very uneasy about this, which was good, because it was supposed to disturb the comfort and comfort the disturbed. And I was getting disturbed. Because I have found, once we think we have spirituality, once we think we have the program, once we think we have God, we have just lost it. We don't. And if spirituality doesn't touch every area of our life, it touches none of our life. We can't have a little bit and the other stuff. So if I have a little bit of God, a little bit of spirituality, and it hasn't hit and affected every single area of my life, I have nothing. That's just the spiritual law that we follow. And I got more disturbed. I got to look at some step two considerations in my current conception of God. And again, I was looking at belief systems that were still present. They just weren't screaming loud, but they were present. And a new step three and into inventory. And I remember it was one afternoon. I called up Mark. It wasn't even my scheduled time to speak to him, but I called him up, and I was talking faster than I am now. This coffee is incredibly strong. Whoa. I'm trying to slow myself down. The caffeine has me going. I was talking 100 miles an hour. And I was trying to explain this incredible thing that I was feeling, this new dimension, this depth and weight, this very tangible God, this very tangible experience. And I remember Mark laughing about this experience. And he says, money, you can't describe what you're trying to describe because it's a God experience. So just be with it. And into inventory. And incredible things began to happen for me, not externally, but internally. My POV, my point of view changed on everything. And I started to hear differently. I remember feeling disturbed by many things that didn't disturb me in the past, and I thought I was just getting grumpy or pompous. I was just getting sensitive to things I couldn't see or hear before. You know, ignorance is bliss, but it isn't good. And sometimes we're happy simply because we're just blind and deaf. And when we wake up and the blinders are taken off and the earplugs are taken out, we start to see things that we're involved in or people we were associating with or just things going on in our own home group that we were totally ignorant to and blind and deaf to, and suddenly all that stuff's taken away. We say, we have a problem here. there's something wrong here. There's something wrong with me even. That doesn't feel good. But it's necessary in order to take proper constructive action, whether it's being still or actually getting active. And by the time I got to step nine, everything had drastically changed for me. And I remember one Saturday afternoon, I didn't know what was going on with me. I thought I was having like this nervous breakdown. We get so dramatic in AA, and I'm having a nervous breakdown. And I didn't see anything to do on the spiritual path, but I can feel this thing going on inside of me. And I had been divorced a few years. I never wept over the divorce. It just got numb. And I was dating. But I never mourned that loss. I never went through the grieving. And what this work did was bring that right to the surface. It pushed it right to the top. And one Saturday, I was up on a Saturday. Just something's not right. And by Saturday afternoon, it finally broke. And I, quite frankly, it's embarrassing to say, but I was weeping uncontrollably. And I didn't know where it was coming from. And I remember thinking about the ex-wife this particular day, but I didn't think that was the cause. And I called up Mark, and I'm trying to talk to him on the phone. And I says, I think it has to do with my divorce. And I'm trying to explain to him. And what he said to me was good and hung up the phone. He's done this. He had done this many times to me when something was spiritually, something was happening to me spiritually. And he called me back a couple hours later and explained to me why. He just said good and hung up the phone. That that was necessary. He couldn't get in the way of that. And so I purged this whole afternoon. And I will tell you that the work brought that about, and that brought about more freedom. And I remember a feeling cleansed. And I finally put the piece of the past to bed. It was maybe a year later, I was able to contact my ex-wife. I caught her at a sober moment, and I made an attempt to make an amends with her, and she wasn't hearing it. It took about 5 years to finally make that amends. This all came about by going through the work again. I was able to make peace with my past. And so when I got through the work, I did it again a year later and did it again in 1 year. I went through the work 3 times, and I was looking to go through the work a 4th time. And that's when I learned about worshiping the methodology rather than the God. And Mark told me, as Don would tell us, go and share the experience rather than being glued in the book. A business which takes no inventory goes broke. But if they're always taking inventory, they're never open for business and will go broke too. So I have to get out there and share about the good news. And when I, after Mark passed, I was working with Gary B. from Indiana and this guy Joe K., who was now in Ohio. And Mickey and I, we would talk for years. And it was a Saturday. I was at a conference. I was supposed to speak that night, and I had called Mickey. And he asked me, are you ready to have a new experience? And we began this relationship, and that's when he gave me Circle and the Triangle. And it's been wondrous, to say the least, and has really steered me back to my religious community. But it's, again, once a year minimum, we go through the work again and see what shakes out and kill off more self. And the thing about alcoholism is we can't see it. I'm not talking about the drinking, because you know when you're drinking, but we can't see alcoholism when it's working on me. I can't see it when it's working on me. There's some glaring things I know, well, that wasn't very sober, Pete, but there's other little things that are very subtle that will kind of get in there, and you can't see it happening. And one of the things I learned about over the last couple of years was the surrender. What's the depth of our surrender, and how many gods are we worshiping when we claim we're only worshiping one God? I worship my reputation, I worship my money, I worship my relationship, I worship my car, worship my job, and I worship God too. Well, it doesn't go that way. Accolades from people, you know. And what I am is a hypocrite before God, because even when I'm on my knees praying to God, it's like I'm praying to you, God, but today you're about 4th on the list. Today we were talking about hidden agendas. How many hidden agendas or secret motives do we have? And the example I brought up was, and you got the man or woman who comes into AA, becomes a big book dumper, and they're all over, and they're right in the middle of AA, and they're sharing and sponsoring, and they meet Mr. or Mrs. AA on campus, and they fall in love, and they get married, and maybe one of them is still making meetings, the other one just shows up now and again, kind of sponsors people. Because the hidden agenda for that person was to meet somebody on campus. And while they were here in Rome, when you're in Rome, do what the Romans do. They're into the book. I'll be into the book. It doesn't take much for someone to regurgitate what they learned in this book. Anybody can do that. But once they meet their hidden agenda, which was to find Mr. or Mrs. AA on campus or get that job and make all that money, this now becomes second, third, or fourth on the list. So you kind of see them around. They don't sound or look the same, but they got the relationship, they got the kids, or they got the money, they got the car, and things are dwindling away. The spiritual muscles are getting flabby. And when we do inventory a lot, when we're doing nightly review a lot, when I say inventory, guys, I'm not talking about something that bounces around in my head because that's dangerous. I'm talking about pen to paper inventory and then discussion. When I say inventory, it's pen to paper and discussion, is that we will uncover and discover many things that we don't even want to look at. That in just writing a simple inventory, it looks like, well, I'm resentful for Joe for doing this. Here's my third and fourth column. And the sponsor will say, well, let's re-examine this. You're not really angry at Joe for doing this. You have an agenda going on. Your ego's all over this. Your pride's all over it. And we start to uncover and discover really what's going on in me, and that's alcoholism. One of the hot buttons for me is I don't like being around people who are hypocrites. It drives me up a wall. And then when my sponsor, I remember the first time I went through the work, he said, how long have you been a hypocrite? And he pointed me with church and my religious community. So usually what I'm accusing someone of, I stand guilty of as well, because that's how I see it. So there's so much to learn here and to experience. On page 25, before we actually get into step 11, kind of set this up. There's two things we look at. Middle of the page is the spiritual awakening. It says the great fact is justice and nothing less than the great fact. It's not just a fact of recovery. He says it's a great fact. That we have had, they're talking in past, like they're talking, looking back on their experience. They're not theorizing. We have had these experiences. It's very reassuring. That we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have completely overhauled or revolutionized, changed our whole or entire attitude toward life where I struggled for so long, toward others, fellows, who I was always in conflict with and combating in my head or outwardly, and towards God's universe. That encompasses the whole planet. Because you have an untreated alcoholic, he has a problem, she has a problem with everything with a pulse. Anything that's breathing, they have a problem with, including the stop sign that's not, the red light that's not flashing quick enough. Why are they doing this to me? I'm in a hurry. George Collins says it best, when you're stuck in traffic, the guy in front of you is going slow is an idiot, and the guy tailgating going fast is a fool. I'm the only one driving proper. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator or God has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we can never do by ourselves, because lack of power is my dilemma. I can't pull this off on my own. I can pretend I'm doing okay, can pretend that I'm operating in a spiritual place, but I'm not. It says if you're seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there's no middle of the road solution. And this middle of the road solution is not following the directions in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, but somehow maintaining sobriety. You know, 90 meetings in 90 days, don't drink, go to meetings, make more coffee, all that stuff, which is fine. But it's not directions on how to have this spiritual revolution. And they're telling us, we believe there's no middle of the road solution for people like us to get well, truly well. not just not drink, but completely change where the point of view on life changes, how we hear life, how we act in life. Our GPS is a new one. We're operating differently, and even, let me say, transcend earthly stuff and live in a godly place. This is way beyond just showing up for a meeting and sharing and, you know, and the camaraderie that goes on, which is wonderful. But we're talking about getting spiritual muscles and living on a spiritual plane, doing a spiritual walk, a walk with God. That changes the whole game. This is about being disciplined to a spiritual life, and how much do I really want to be changed deep down, deep and effective, all the way down, be made fundamentally different. The things I was attracted to at the beginning, I'm no longer attracted to. My language, the way I used to speak, I can't even use those words anymore. The people I would go out with, I don't want to fly over them anymore. Everything has changed. And yet, I have more empathy for folks who are sick and suffering than I ever did before. We become agents for God, which is what the book is talking about. We're in a position where life was becoming impossible. If I'm sober a bunch of years and my life is still feeling impossible, I'm missing something. If I'm in this thing a long time and I believe I'm a real alcoholic, because some of us come into AA and we find out we're not alcoholics, we're just hard drinkers. Or I just use a lot of drugs, I've hooked on opiates, but I'm not what they talk about, this addict person. But if I really believe I'm alcoholic and I'm in here a while, and I'm still relapsing, or I'm still in that place of what we call struggle, where life is just heavy every single day, I'm missing something. I'm missing the drastic and revolutionary change. I'm missing it. And some of us will never get it, because we just don't want to completely surrender to this way of living. So am I in a position where my life is becoming impossible or is now impossible? I can't get sober. I've been doing this for 10, 15 years. I can't get sober. Am I a real alcoholic? A. And if I am, have I really digested step one? Chances are I haven't, and I have more road to run. And some of us find sobriety when we die, which is something we think will never happen to us when we're running. They're dying all over, but not me. I'm different. I'm special. So we're in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, meaning her or him or external things are no longer fixing me, I had two alternatives. And this is where we can get disturbed, because there's another door, number three, the one I want. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. That's one door. And the other is to accept spiritual help. Two doors. There's no third door. So if I'm in this deal, and I'm not following the instruction in this book, and I'm still struggling, I'm headed for that bitter end. There's no third door. It's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. I'm going to get drunk. And for an alcoholic to drink, my book says, is to die. And somehow I think that won't happen to me, which means my ego is way out of control and I become incredibly arrogant because I know better than God. All right? That makes sense? And the other, to accept spiritual help. Accepting spiritual help means that my life is none of my business. I'm going to follow the directions put in front of me because I don't want to go on to this bitter end. No third door. By the way, I'm not saying we're going to become priests or nuns or monks and live pristine and perfect, because we're not. 6 and 7 reminds us how flawed we are. If my history is correct, in the 7-step prayer, they use the words holding back nothing, if I'm correct. Because they knew we were going to hold back stuff. While we're striving for spirituality, we're still going to hold on to defects. That's how flawed we are. So I'm not talking about being pristine and perfect, but understanding that I'm going to fall short. I'm gonna make mistakes, but I'm striving to get right with Spirit, get right with this power called God. And what step 11 allows us to do once we access this power is to enhance the experience, to constantly flush out what's in the way, to grow in understanding and effectiveness, so I can be of greater service to God and those around me. And so we look at step 11. And it talks about what I do at night and what I'm supposed to do on awakening in the morning. I always wondered why Bill put the night first. Usually would start with the morning and then go to night. But how often have we woke up on Tuesday morning with Monday all over us? Right? Because I did nothing about the stuff that went on Monday. I go to bed, and Tuesday morning, I wake up, the 12 and 12 talks about the emotional hangover. Imagine doing that every day, day after day, after day, after day, and not having a little something to deal with that, like a double. Right? Just give me a double, just wash this day away. Honey, give me a martini, give me a glass of wine. What a day. And we fall asleep. Still wake up with it, but it goes away for a while. Now, we're not drinking, and we got the stuff that we're carrying into the next day, as that's more stuff carrying into the next day. And at some point, I got to blow my brains out just to shut the voices off in my head. So Bill says, let's get us at night before we put our head on the pillow. And so he says, when we retire at night, he doesn't say what time, by the way. So I used to wait till like 11 o'clock at night to do this, and my head was on the pillow, and I say, oh, I got to get up out of bed, write inventory, pray, I'll do it tomorrow. I'm tired. Doing a commercial, Leno, I'll get up and do all this stuff, you know. And my sponsor pointed out to me, if I'm home and it's 7 o'clock at night, I'm retired for the night. I can do it then. So when I retire tonight, when I put closure on my day, I constructively review my day. They're not looking to bring us down and tear us down here. We're gonna learn by the mistakes we made. And it asks us some questions. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology, an amends to someone? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Not when it's convenient for me, not when I'm in the mood to, but at once. In step 10, they use the word immediately. What Bill's getting at, you got to get the stuff cleaned up right away, because it becomes plaque on the soul. It's a little wedge. Can't feel it, can't see it, but a little wedge between, if you will, me and God. And we do the next thing the next day, another wedge between me and God. And one day we have this boulder between me and God. And I'm wondering, why do I feel lost? How come I can't connect? It started with the first one. And so I was brought up in AA from my first sponsor about pen to paper, always writing inventory. And have I missed nights over 29 years? Absolutely. Have I missed a lot of nights over 29 years? No. It's something I'll do it tonight, God willing, I get home. Whether I get home and it's a late night or I'm home early. Last week, 2 weeks ago, I had something that was heavy, which bled into like two things, which bled into five things. Next thing I know, I'm fighting the whole Roman legion. And it's about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm tossing and turning, and I'm just so tired from work, thinking, deluding myself that I can do this in the morning. I can't sleep. Now it's like 1:30, now it's like 2 o'clock. And I know what I need to do, because I've done this so many times in the past. I drag myself out of bed. I go into my prayer room, which is kind of like an office in a prayer room. I go to my desk, and I get out my inventory book. I get out a pen, turn on the light, make a quick prayer, pick up the pen, and I start writing resentment, cause, effect, remedy, fault, resentment, the whole thing. I did about half a dozen inventories. Right now it's after 2 o'clock in the morning. I made a prayer, and I fell asleep almost instantly. Because when we're writing inventory, very often as you're writing inventory, you're realizing it's much ado about nothing. That's longer the hours that may have been worthwhile, but up in the head, it's a war zone. When it gets exposed to the light, it begins to die. And what I did the very next morning was call my sponsor, and I shared with him what happened and read the inventory to him. And by then it had lost its steam. But what he did for me was uncover things I couldn't see in the inventory. Because what we want to do, guys, is... okay. It's one thing protecting myself from stuff. Protecting myself from toxic people. Protecting myself from things that are out there that might cause me harm. The way if I see a burglar, God forbid, in my backyard, I call 911, get the gun, if I have a gun, lock the doors, get the family in one room to protect myself from that burglar till the authorities arrive. But I haven't gotten rid of the burglar, he's still there. So we protect ourselves, we gear up and protect ourselves, gotta watch for this defect, gotta watch for these type of people, we do all this stuff. So we're protecting, insulating ourselves from this stuff, but we haven't healed it, it hasn't been removed. Because it's going to come back the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and at a weak moment, it's going to get in. So I need to heal myself from that stuff. That comes through inventory prayer and a good sponsor. Because the sponsor can hear what I'm not saying and can see what I can't see. And I can see how blind I am, if you will. So that's what happened that particular morning after what I did that night. And what I do in the evening, and I've been dead tired many times. Michael and I talk about this often. You know, you're exhausted. We work in the same business. So does Ryan. And sometimes you're just cooked. You're around sometimes very struggling folks, toxic folks. And you're in the middle of it all day long. And then you go to a meeting. And in the parking lot, you hear 300 fifth steps. And you get home and you're cooked. And all you want to do is sleep. I just want to sleep, but I can't yet. So we go in, we write inventory, make some prayer, make some meditation, then you sleep. So my book says, was I kind and loving toward all? What could I have done better? Was I thinking of myself most of the time? If I'm an alcoholic, chances are I was thinking of myself a few times during the day. Or was I thinking of what I can do for others, of how I could pack into the stream of life? Then it gives me something to consider. I'm sorry? 86. Third edition. But I must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Why? Because that would diminish my usefulness to others. The idea of doing this inventory is not to break me down to the point where I'm going, oh my God, I can't believe this, but to fix me, to tweak what's wrong, so I can go out and be of service. By the way, if I'm loaded with guilt and remorse, it's just ego coming in and pride coming in through the back door. I can't believe I did this. But I'm a flawed character. I'm going to fall short. Because if we weren't falling short anymore, they would eliminate step 10 and 11. You just do 4 and get on with your life. After making our review, our inventory, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. I think last week we talked about a lot of times it comes down to forgiveness or making amends, forgiving someone or making amends. And out of this inventory, I will often see I need to pray for forgiveness, I need to forgive Joe or Mary, or I need to go make amends to Joe or Mary. Now my ego is going to say, well, that's a little Mickey Mouse amends, but I don't know the impact of it until I go make that amends. I don't know the impact in my life of forgiveness, how much healing will come from that until I do it. Yes? So I get home and I find myself pretty disciplined to this. It's not by me, it's just by this power that we access and being disciplined to this life and wanting to experience my God more, where I have inventory books, notepads that I write inventory. And I do these questions in a 4-column inventory. I've been doing it that way forever. Resentment, cause, effects, where I'm at fault. I write a fear inventory. What am I fearful? Why do I have this fear? I'm selfishly trying to control and manage this fear by what I'm doing in the face of fear. I'm not trusting or relying upon God to care and protect me. Maybe I'm angry with an institution. I'm very often writing inventory on the treatment center industry, and I'm in it. Or insurance companies on what they're doing to the business. I often write those inventories. And in inventory, I get to see that things are they are because of the powers that be. I need to forgive and practice some acceptance, and I get past it. Get on the horse and keep riding. It's constantly moving. And we come to the morning. Now, I will say, in many folks I speak to, a lot of us are good in the morning. We'll make prayer. You know, we'll do a little gung-ho, pot of coffee, six Red Bulls, and a pack of cigarettes. We're ready to pray and meditate. Trying to stay still, and I'm vibrating from all the Red Bulls. But a lot of us are good out of the gate in the morning. A lot of folks I speak to, even if they're in, you know, they're not doing so good, I ask them about their prayer life, and many of them will say they pray in the morning. No meditation, but they pray. Making some contact. But those very same folks, and sometimes even more, the nightly review doesn't exist. The nightly prayer doesn't exist. And the nightly meditation doesn't exist. It hasn't existed for a long time. The book doesn't say go into meditation and pray at night for an hour and a half. It doesn't even give us a time. What Zach needs is what God determines, and what I need is what God determines. It could be two different times. Zach needs 2 minutes, I need an hour and a half. I don't know. But I need to do that. I get to do that at night, and we'll watch. We take a poll. When's the last time you prayed and meditated wrote inventory at night? You met with silence. Or you met with, well, I used to do that. That's not the question. The question is, what are you currently doing? And I only could eat off a current experience. I can't eat off of last week's lunch. That's gone. And very often when this stuff's going on, you will see in actions how well somebody is. You will see their belief systems and what they do, not what we say. I was guilty of that when I was coming around. I remember telling my sponsor, I didn't write any inventories. How come? I said, had a great day. It was a fabulous day. And he says, well, duplicate that day for the rest of your life. You don't need God or AA, and hung up the phone. Now it wasn't a perfect day. Right? So on awakening, it says we think about that we're not out the door yet. It says on awakening, so I take that as on awakening, which means I'm laying in bed, the eyes open, I'm waking up. That's where it gets me. Because if you notice, you pay attention, tomorrow morning, God willing, we all wake up. Watch when you wake up, the conversation has already started. You have to catch, you have to jump on. They're not waiting for you. They're not waiting to start to, when you get there. It's already going as soon as you're up, and it's going 100 miles an hour, and there's 45 people talking at once. And you're dipping in and out. And before you get out of bed, you've been angry, lustful, romantic, spiritual, athletic. You've made money, lost money. You're up 5 minutes. Amen. My sponsors say, ask any alcoholic how they're doing. They'll always tell you, I'm so tired. Because I've been talking to all these people since I woke up this morning. It's exhausting. So a book says, let's get them on awakening. Bill says, on awakening. We think, we haven't done anything, about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin doing anything, we go to the boss. My sponsor says, be a beggar before God. Beg for mercy. Beg for guidance. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially, they're emphasizing, that it be divorced, taken away from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives, the hidden agendas, the hidden motives. Any alcoholic or an addict with a motive ought to be considered armed and dangerous. So they're asking, we're going to God to separate me from these hidden agendas, these self-seeking motives. I'm being kind, but I got a motive. I'm loaning you money, but I have a motive. I volunteered to do service at my group, but I have a motive. And the motive is accolades. Look at me. That's not humility. That's prideful. That's ego, which drives a wedge between me and God. Let me be a beggar before my God. Under these conditions that we just described, we can employ mental faculties with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use. I think last week we touched on proper use of the will and managing our life, or proper use of the will and self-will. So we ask God for thought, inspiration, intuitiveness to guide us, to give us all we need to do a task he's put before us. And we throw everything we have at it because it's in line with God's will. But then we have the self-seeking motive that we're looking for something out of this. We're attached to an outcome. Now it becomes me managing it and self-reliance and self-will, which means I'm going to hurt someone and at the end of the day, probably me. Make sense? That's why we do this for fun and for free. If there was a price tag on sponsorship, we'd all have self-seeking motives going on. Oh, there's Joe. He has a lot of money. I'll sponsor him. I really care about you. Let me help you with the step. Pay me. Self-seeking motive. I was joking today with some folks where I work about the self-seeking motives that are hidden agendas. And not to embarrass any of the men in here, but I'm going to embarrass some of the men in here. So you got like 40 days sober, and you sit with your friends in the meeting, in the back row, and none of you drink coffee. No one even likes coffee. But you're sitting there waiting for the speaker to come there and get the meeting going, and you're just shooting the breeze with each other, talking about the game you're going to go to and what we're doing over the weekend. And then she walks in with her friends, who happens to be a coffee drinker. The coffee pot's right behind you. And suddenly you have this unbelievable urge to get a cup of coffee. You want coffee? I'm in the mood for coffee. Let's have some coffee. You don't even like coffee. But you like who's getting coffee. And suddenly you find yourself by the coffee pot, pouring a cup of coffee. And you look at her, and she looks at you, and you're ready to plan the names of your children. I'm just getting coffee for my friends, Mike. I'm not doing anything, I swear. I wanted a cup of coffee. Mike's an elder, says, sit down. See that? We do that in a lot of areas. The self-seeking motive. So what I do, this happened to me, it was brought to me. I was really early in sobriety, and I woke up one morning, and I swear I was just grateful that I was in a clean bed and sober. And I wasn't thinking of this, but I opened up my eyes, and I said, thank you, God, for this day. And I've been doing that pretty consistently when I wake up in the morning. Thank you, God, for this day. And for some of us who are older, past 50, you get real grateful for seeing another day. It's like, thank you, God, another day. And what I do is take care of some personal stuff, and I go into my prayer room. And what I used to do years ago was do lots of reading in the morning, and I don't do that. I got very attached to all these, 24-hour day daily reflections, read the 11th step, upper room, our daily bread, all the stuff. And I'm reading and reading and reading. I'm exhausted. And if I would leave the house and forgot to read one page, I'd have to go back. And so I was attached to this reading stuff. And I have all these things at my altar, and my sponsor pointed out to me, let's make sure we don't worship the altar either. Think about that. Because somebody who's praying in a jungle has just as much conscious contact with God as I do in front of an altar. And he was just trying to raise the level of awareness of being caught into the sage, the candles, the this, the that. And then you find the only thing who's praying and meditating are the objects and not you. Because you're more aware of that stuff than the power. So I got away from reading. Occasionally I'll read. I usually do reading when I'm done with my practice in the morning. I like to read in the morning, whether it's big books, some other books I'm working with, or scripture. But I usually do that after I'm done. And I find myself even more centered. And so I hit my knees, and I work with some prayers in the morning. All coming from a place of surrender, daily surrender, for successful living. And I have a tendency to pray for many folks. And so that's what I do. I pray for many folks with my family and friends and people hurting and whatever it might be. And even those who I call enemies or people I know have tried to hurt me or trying to hurt me, I pray for them, and my prayers are I forgive them. And a couple other things I work with in prayer. And then what I do is I have a posture that I work with in meditation, and then I sit in meditation. And as the whole posture I follow, it's important to breathe and have the channels clear, and I sit. And sometimes meditation can be as short as 10 minutes, and sometimes meditation can be 20 or 30 or 40 minutes. I'm not in charge of that. I just, as God moves me. And so it depends on where God has me. I will tell you, the power of prayer and the power of meditation has done incredible things for me personally as far as healing goes and awareness and answering the riddles in life that we all have and healing those things that we have that hurt us and getting to see things different, because something happens when we go into darkness to see and silence to hear. Things clear up. And sitting there just waiting for God to deliver something. And sometimes all we'll get in the meditation is just stillness, which is so much better than the noise. In fact, when we start meditating and try to get silent, we don't have the power to do that, but we're trying to get silent, we realize how noisy we really are. When you start to meditate and your sponsor says, sit this way and breathe and just still the mind, you realize, oh my God, I got like all this stuff going. This is how I've been operating for the longest time. I got noise. And this is how I live out of this noise. So at the beginning, it can be disturbing. Fast forward, and we have a life of prayer and meditation. What we can get into, as I discussed a moment ago, is worshiping the stuff. Worshipping the methodology and looking for this big bang in meditation. We're looking for something to seize part, the sky parts, just give me something, God. And we start to invent events that happen in meditation. They never happened. And what happens to us, and is it all the Thomas Merton talks a whole lot about this and much better than I can ever do in my lifetime, but what happens is we're looking for that stuff and we're not getting it, thinking we hit the desert meditation and nothing's going to grow, and I'm not getting these neon lights happening, I'm not getting these clear messages, and we pack it in. And we just go back to quick prayer meditation, because that's what the majority of folks are doing. And yet, if we can walk on that barefoot on cobblestones, if you want, a rocky road, in this desert, although it feels like suffering, God has stripped us down to a point where we will experience the fruition of all that work. But it's nothing like we planned. We can't see where we're going. It comes in spirituality. You can't. We want to see where we're going, but you can't. And so we can get quickly attached to, I need all the bells and whistles. If I don't get it, I got to make bells and whistles. I had a guy telling me, true story. He says, Pete, I was meditating. I put a candle on in front of me. And he says, I looked at the candle and the flame bent. And I thought, was your window open? Maybe it was you breathing on it. Maybe it was God, but he was looking for something profound to happen with one candle in front of him. He was sober about 30 days. Now, God will speak to someone maybe with 3 days. But what he was looking for was, give me something to say I've had this experience. So what I did, like an elder, I didn't shut it down. I says, that's wonderful. That's keep at it. Because it was something. More than he ever had. But the moral of the story is we can start looking for stuff. And so while I'm looking over there, God's over here. And sometimes we'll hit that spot where it just feels like I'm walking barefoot on a rocky road in the middle of a desert and everything is barren. And why am I doing this? This is getting me nowhere. And that's the wall we have to knock down. What appears to be suffering, because we interpret it as suffering, can actually be great healing and transcending everything we knew. I was sharing with some folks earlier. I got to be real careful about traditions here. So if you allow me some latitude. So they get the carpenter, and they torture him, they beat him, suffering, they inflict upon him, and they nail this guy to a cross. Right? Beat him to death, basically. No human would survive that. They've done these studies. No human would have survived that. And then they nail him to the cross. And they put him up, nailed to a cross. Think about this for a minute. Even nailed to the cross after the beating he took, he was still above everyone else, and they still had to look up to him. Even the people who did that to him still had to look up. Metaphorically, it's as spiritual as you can get. And what appeared to be suffering was actually tremendous freedom for everyone. So when we're going through this stuff, and we're really in this book, when we're in this work, what appears to be suffering, or God sending me the trials of Job, is just God freeing us of our stuff, of self. Oh my God, I'm suffering. I just lost that job and I have no money. The reason why you have no money, because if you had any more money, God will lose you. You're going to get just enough money not to need God. So God says, we're not having this. I'm taking everything from you. I'm suffering, oh my God, not realizing the delight in all of that. But the mind gets in and says, oh, this is not good. She left me because God said, if she stayed, I lose you. And God's going to any lengths to have a relationship with us because we have work to do for him. I'm insisting on having a relationship. God says, you're going to go through life without one. And what I do is I push my will up against God's will, and here comes fear and suffering until I completely surrender. Do with me as you see fit. Third step prayer. I don't care what you send me. I don't care what you do in my life. I completely surrender. I'm here to work for you. Suddenly, we're in the world like a loose garment. You see how Don't Drink and Go Meetings doesn't even measure up to this stuff when we're on a spiritual walk? What we're losing, what we're missing when we settle for just don't drink, go to meetings, meeting makers make it. We're walking around with all of that stuff, going from meeting to meeting to meeting, trying to protect ourselves from ourselves, and we can't. And we stumble and fall and get loaded and come back, and everyone gets this white chip. We get a standing ovation and do it all over again. I think I said this once before. I would love to see a meeting where the white chips is met with silence. We're glad you're back. We're not going to applaud for you ruining your life again and probably ruining your wife or husband's life and your kid's life and your employee's life. We're going to give you a standing ovation for that. It gets louder and louder. What would happen when I'm getting on the soapbox. If we gave away white chips, anyone taking a white chip tonight, the room was dead silent. Just think about the impact that would have. Maybe it would bring some truth to that person when I'm walking up to the room. God forbid, hopefully not me again. Walking up to the room, and it's quiet. I'm taking a white chip. Rather than, way to go. He OD 10 times this week. Let's give him the wave. It's nuts. I understand why we do it, and we want to make you feel welcome. I get it. And we're glad you're back and alive. And that I mean from my heart. Plotting? I don't know. That's me. How am I doing on time, guys? Almost 9 o'clock. Okay. So then I go into meditation. I usually do some reading. Now, they give us instructions what to do when we're going through the day. And there's something really key here. And we can call it pump the brakes. They use the word pause. We pause when agitated or doubtful, which means we're going to get from time to time agitated about something or doubtful about something. We're not sure, go left or right. Speak or be silent. It says pause, and we wait for the right thought or action. It's going to come from this power called God. If we're clear, we can hear. Sometimes it'll come, maybe Zach will say something over a cup of coffee and go, that's it. Maybe we're talking about this dilemma. I don't know what to do. And Kostas, well, I went through the same thing, man. This is how, oh, got it. makes perfect sense now. So we pump the brakes. And pause doesn't mean for like a minute or two. It could be. Sometimes pause could be just pause. Do nothing. Which is very difficult for me as an alcoholic just to do nothing. I need to do something. But pause. When agitated or doubtful. On page 88, it says, when I'm practicing these principles, I am in much less danger of excitement. They're not talking about excitement at a ball game when your team is winning. You know that thing that you're kind of like just reacting to stuff, and you're just in every little gossip click that's going on, and you're riding off of people's emotions. We're in much less danger of that type of stuff, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, and foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. The knife has gotten sharper. We do not tire so easily because we're not burning up energy foolishly to try to get the world to do what we want. With me? It tells me a promise that this stuff works. It really does. It tells me I'm an alcoholic. I'm undisciplined. So I need to be disciplined to a spiritual life. It says, so we let God discipline us in a simple way we've just outlined. Now I think I'm done. And it says, this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. I can have faith, but if I don't take action, then faith is dead indeed. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. And when we get there next week, we're going to see there's no discussion on the spiritual awakening because we've had it. They're going to tell us what to do with this precious gift of the spiritual awakening. Homes, occupations, and affairs, and our primary purpose, go work with the drunk. All right? That's all I got. Peace.